The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So, good morning again. I'll introduce myself and then I'll do my little talk. So, I'm Jean Haley. I know some of you. I've been practicing maybe 15 or 16 years. Started out in Zen, and then I discovered Vipassana, which was exciting. I actually learned how to meditate when I went to a Vipassana retreat. It was with Steve Armstrong and Kamala Masters many years ago. Recently I've been also doing a little Tibetan practice with Turgar, Nyingma Rinpoche's organization. So in another part of my life, I'm a clinical social worker. I have a psychotherapy practice in St. Paul, and I also volunteer some of my time at the Walk-In Counseling Center in Minneapolis. And I teach mindfulness-based stress reduction and other things at the Center for Spirituality and Healing. And I've been able to work with people with traumatic brain injury and chemical dependency. And I'll be working with people with early stage Alzheimer's, teaching them to be mindful. So that part of my work is really exciting. My son's name is Alex, he's 31, and he and I are also in the Community Dharma Leaders Program through Spirit Rock, which we're finishing up. So it's really lovely to be able to share the Dharma with my son. It's very rich. So I feel very honored and humbled to be here with you today, and I'm going to talk a little bit about something that's called the luminous mind, which is one of my kind of my favorite concepts in the Dharma. So I'm going to start with the words of the Buddha. Luminous, monks, is the mind, brightly shining. And it is defiled by incoming defilements. Luminous, monks, is the mind, and it is freed from incoming defilements. Luminous, monks, is the mind, defiled by incoming defilements. The uninstructed run-of-the-mill person doesn't discern that as it actually is present, which is why I tell you that. For the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person, there is no development of the mind. Luminous, monks, is the mind, and it is freed from incoming defilements. The well-instructed disciple of the noble ones discerns that as it actually is present, which is why I tell you that. For the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones, there is development of the mind. So I don't know what your reaction is to that passage, but when I first heard the term luminous mind, I just felt so joyful, really, that there was something clear and bright that was quite different from my own experience of the mind, which is full of the defilements. I don't know what your experience is, but mine is. And that not only was a luminous mind possible, but that one could develop it if one were on the path. If one were not the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person, and everyone here actually is in that other category, just by being here, we're on the path together, we're the well-instructed disciples of the Noble One. So that it's possible just through the development. It's not something that has to be given to us by someone else. That through our own efforts we can develop this luminosity. So one metaphor that's used to describe this kind of relationship between the mind's natural luminosity and the defilements. So the defilements, as I'm sure you're aware, being anger and delusion. So the metaphor that's sometimes used is the metaphor of water, which has this natural clarity, this natural pureness, that then one drops dye into it. So dropping red dye into it becomes colored red, or black dye becomes colored black, But the actual quality of the mind, this actual clarity, this purity of the water, doesn't change. It's just momentarily colored by, if you want to call it, the defilements of the dye. Another metaphor that's used, and this is one that's used by Ajahn Mun, who was a great master in the Thai forest tradition, who is the teacher of the teacher of the teachers that many of us are familiar with now, so people like Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein. So Ajahn Mun was the teacher of Ajahn Chah, and he used this metaphor. It says, the mind is something more radiant than anything else can be. But because counterfeits, passing defilements, come and obscure it, it loses its radiance, like the sun when obscured by clouds. Don't go thinking that the sun goes after the clouds. Instead, the clouds come drifting along and obscure the sun. So this luminosity is there, it's present, it just gets obscured by those clouds, the defilements. So this luminous mind is also described in the suttas. There are many adjectives, but some are the unconditioned, the other shore, the unproliferated, the naturally undistressed, the shelter. So what does the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones do to develop this mind that the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person, I love that phrase, doesn't? And how can we, as being in the former category, develop this bright mind? So, as I mentioned, although the Buddha taught that the luminous mind is possible for all of us, for anyone who's well-instructed in the path, he also taught that we need to develop it. So to use the kind of the modern language of neuroscience, you could say that what we need to do is that we need to have intention. So we need to have the will to do this. We need to set the intention. We need to have attention. So we need to pay attention. And we need to make effort. So we need to practice. And by doing that, then this luminosity becomes effortless. So Thanissara Bhikkhu, who you may be familiar with, he's a contemporary American Theravadan monk. He's also a scholar and a translator. He's the abbot of the Metta Monastery in San Diego. He says that awakening, this awakening to the luminous mind, depends on a, quote, a path of practice that has to be willed. So again, there's this intention to do this, and then the effort that is required to follow that path. So that path of practice, according to the Buddha, is based on what he calls the four determinations. You know, the Buddha likes things that were numbered, because it was an oral tradition, so it's a way to remember things. So that the first is the determination to not neglect discernment. The second is the determination to preserve the truth. The third is the determination to develop relinquishment, and the fourth is the determination to train for peace. So I'm going to talk about each one of those briefly. So the first one, the determination to not neglect discernment. So interesting words, to not neglect discernment. So he's implying that discernment's already there. It's just when we don't have it, when we don't practice it, when we neglect it, that we fall off this path that's going to lead us to the luminous mind. So you could think of this discernment as just the process of understanding how it is we fabricate our own reality. And we all do this, maybe you've noticed that, we make up stories about our lives, and we sometimes forget that we're doing that. We take what we're fabricating in our minds to be the truth. So by not neglecting that discernment, then we're remembering to pay attention to what's really going on, to always be looking, so what is going on here? What are the stories that I'm making up about my life? How am I identifying with my personal experience. How am I making all of this about me? How do these stories kind of get us locked into these patterns of mind that obstruct the luminosity of our mind and that keep us from freedom? So again, the first one is to not neglect discernment, to remember that we can discern, we can pay attention, we can see what's going on. And of course, we see that all the time when we meditate. So the second determination is the determination to preserve the truth. So again, it's implying that the truth is there, right? What we're doing is we're working to preserve it. And so this means to honestly look at our habits of mind that keep us stuck and to be truthful about that. So we sometimes have the capacity to lie about what's going on. And so to just notice that without judgment, oh, okay, so here I am really not kind of wanting to see what's going on, maybe not being truthful about it. And to be kind of vigilant about that, again, not to be judgmental about it, and to recognize that sometimes we're not being truthful about what it is we're telling ourselves or others, for that matter. And that even though we may still be attached to whatever it is that's leading to this untruthfulness, that we can open to that, that we can notice it. So that's the determination to preserve the truth. Excuse me. The third one is the determination to develop relinquishment. So when we discern the causes of our suffering and how it is we get stuck, and then we have this willingness to be truthful about that, to say, okay, this is what I'm doing, then we develop a determination to relinquish those things that are perpetuating that, that are keeping us stuck, that are getting in the way of freedom. So we see clearly what those things are that are unskillful or that are causing suffering, and we see the things that are skillful or that are leading to happiness or freedom. And we begin to develop the determination to relinquish those things that are causing us suffering and to cultivate those that are leading to happiness. And the fourth one is the determination to train for peace. So this practice of relinquishment, of giving up those things that are unskillful and turning the mind to those that are skillful, with that comes a growing commitment to a deeper and deeper state of peace. And that comes through our own experience, right? So we see, oh, okay, this is how I feel when I don't engage in these things that are causing me suffering. And this is how I feel when I'm behaving skillfully or thinking skillfully. And with that, then we have this increased determination to go deeper and deeper into the practice, to go deeper into peace. So this is kind of this is what the Buddha saw right on the night of his enlightenment. He saw the causes and conditions of our suffering, and that we can actually touch into this unconditioned, this luminous mind. So I find that incredibly inspiring, and you might just touch into what sort of reaction you have as I speak to this. So this is called the opening of the eye of wisdom, Mahasati, or the great mindfulness. So again, it's seeing beyond the distortions, the possibility that we can practice seeing beyond the distortions and our fabrications that we overlay on reality, and that we can actually connect to wholeness, to this luminosity in the moment, moment by moment. So I'm sure you're aware of the four foundations of mindfulness, which is kind of the basis of this practice. And the third foundation of mindfulness addresses mindfulness of the mind, or citta in Pali, or the knowing of, again, the knowing of connecting to these states of mind, or these things that are passing through the stream of the mind in any moment. So that's our mental states, our emotions, and how we are relating to them. And we can do that, again, in a non-judgmental and non-preferential way. So what precisely is going on right now? And can I be truthful about that? And can I notice what it is that's causing happiness and what's causing suffering? And can I continue on this path in the pursuit of peace? So these are the words of the Buddha. The practitioner knows or comprehends. The mind is like this. So I think that's just so beautiful. The mind is like this. It's not like this mind is bad and that mind is good. It's just the knowing of it. The mind is like this. The mind is obscured or unobscured. The mind is luminous or conditioned. Just the mind is like this. And that's really all that's necessary to do. It's neither good nor bad. It's just the knowing of it. So that is so simple and so encouraging to me anyways, that this is available to all of us just by paying attention. So in my own experience, I can sometimes glimpse this luminosity, this peace of mind, just by kind of paying attention to the gaps between all this other stuff that's going through the mind, the ceaseless activity of the mind, and to intentionally move my mind into that gap. So Ajahn Sumedho, maybe you've heard this, talks about when you walk into a room, looking for the space as opposed to the objects in the room. So maybe you just want to spend a moment now to see if you can bring your attention in this room and see actually the space as opposed to the bodies that are sitting here or the furniture or the fans or the walls. Just connecting to the space that we so often ignore. We're so focused on the objects, as in the objects in our mind. But just relaxing the mind into that space. So that's a very simple practice that you could experiment with if you haven't already. It allows us again to see the kind of the gaps in our experience, to see what it is we're missing when we're so focused on the objects in our mind. So when you enter this space the next time, or go to your home or wherever you're going, you might intentionally turn the mind to look at the space as opposed to the objects. So that's just a practice of turning the mind in that direction. So this is called, referred to as the great reversal. So moving from the contracted mind to a state of spaciousness. So we can also sometimes connect to that spaciousness or that luminosity of mind just through something simple like listening. So let's spend a moment and just listen to the sound of the bell. Pretty difficult to be caught in the conditioned mind when we're just listening to the sound of a bell. So another practice that we can use to turn our mind in that direction of the luminous mind. So those are simple practices, and then there's the more concentrated practice of going on retreat, of sitting in meditation for half an hour or an hour, whatever it is we do. And if we go on a long retreat, as I'm sure some of you have done, then we have a great opportunity to look at how our mind gets caught and how we neglect discernment. So I'll just share my own personal story on a recently completed a 2-month retreat at Spirit Rock. And I was finding myself getting really tied up in suffering over the fact that my neighbor snored. And I don't know how you feel about snoring, but I have a lot of aversion to snoring. And so because I was pretty, there wasn't a lot of distraction, I was really caught in this. And I was noticing how I was creating all these stories about myself just in relationship to just the simple sound of snoring. And I was discovering that I was making up stories about, I'm a person who can't sleep when they're snoring. and I'm a person who is X and Y. All this selfing or this creation of the self, just in reaction to sound. And I saw just this incredible amount of suffering in that. And this proliferation, or papancha is the Pali word, this proliferation of the stories, just around really what was just ear consciousness. It was ear, my ear making contact with the sound. And then the mind starts going, okay, I can't stand snoring, I'm a person, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to get tired and I'm not going to be able to concentrate and all that. And it was so clear how I was getting distracted from the luminosity of my mind. So just, you know, two earplugs later and just seeing this, I was able to pretty much let go of it and to rest back into what Ajahn Amaro calls the natural peace and ease of the mind. I love that phrase. So just resting back into the natural peace and ease of the mind from all these stories that we create. So I'd like to invite you, the next time you find yourself caught in this suffering, whether it's around snoring or whatever it is that trips your buttons, to just kind of relax back and to remind yourself that this luminosity is possible, this spaciousness is possible, and to remember the four determinations that the Buddha taught, the determination to not neglect discernment that's already there, the determination to preserve the truth, so to be truthful with ourselves about what's going on, the determination to develop relinquishment, so to kind of set the intention to notice and to let go of those things that are causing us suffering and to turn the mind to the skillful or those that cause happiness and to train for peace, to just continue the practice so that we can achieve a greater and greater depth of peace. And then the mind will start to reveal itself, the unfettered mind, the unconditional mind, the free mind. Luminosity is available to all of us here and now. So I want to end with a poem that I really like, and then we'll have a few minutes for questions if there are any. And I think it speaks to this luminosity. So this is called The Silence of the Stars, and it's by David Wagoner. So the poem starts out by mentioning somebody named Lawrence Vanderpost. Anybody know who he was? You do? Okay. So he lived in South Africa. He was a white man who lived in South Africa. He was a friend of Carl Jung, and he became quite mystical in his later life. And he went out and lived for lengths of time with the Bushmen in the Kalahari Desert. So this is a poem about him, The Silence of the Stars. When Lawrence Vanderpost one night in the Kalahari Desert told the Bushmen he couldn't hear the stars singing, they didn't believe him. They looked at him, half smiling. They examined his face to see whether he was joking or deceiving them. Then two of those small men who plant nothing, who have almost nothing to hunt, who live on almost nothing, and with no one but themselves, led him away from the crackling thorn scrub fire and stood with him under the night sky and listened. One of them whispered, "Do you not hear them now?" And Vanderpost listened, not wanting to disbelieve, but had to answer, "No." They walked in slowly like a sick man to the small, dim circle of firelight and told him they were terribly sorry. And he felt even sorrier for himself and blamed his ancestors for their strange loss of hearing, which was his loss now. On some clear nights, when nearby houses have turned off their televisions, when the traffic dwindles, when through streets are between sirens, and the jets overhead are between crossings, we've heard a lot of jets this morning, when the wind is hanging fire in the fir trees, and the long-eared owl in the neighboring grove between calls is regarding his own darkness, I look at the stars again as I first did, to school myself in the names of the constellations, and remember my first sense of their terrible distance. I can still hear what I thought at the edge of silence, where the inside jokes of my heartbeat, my arterial traffic, the sea above high sea of my inner ear, myself tunelessly humming. But now I know what they are, my fair share of the music of the spheres and clusters of the ripening stars, of the songs from the throats of the old gods, still tending even tone-deaf creatures through their exiles in the desert. So thank you for your attention. And we've got, I think, about 5 minutes if anybody has any questions or anything that they would like to share on this or other topic. Yes.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
See you in the conference. I have kind of a question having to keep you diving the coach.
Okay.
And if you don't have an answer, you know, I don't really expect one.
Thank you.
So
thanks. Does everyone? Yeah. So I'll see if I can do it. So it was a question about the diamond approach. Does everyone know what the diamond approach is? Okay. So the diamond approach is a spiritual path, I guess, that was developed by someone named Hamid Ali, who his pen name was H.H. Almas. He's a Sufi, I think, by training, but he's kind of incorporated a variety of different teachings into his teaching, which is called the Diamond Approach. He actually was the therapist of Jack Kornfield. So the Diamond Approach, there's a kind of a practice, and he talks about the essence, or the pearl. And so thank you for giving me permission to not have the answer to that. I'm relatively new to the diamond approach, so I don't feel completely confident to speak. Yes, yeah. So the question was, how do you reconcile that with the idea of finding our essence? So some would call it Buddha nature, although in this tradition here, that's not talked about so much. And how do you reconcile his idea of this essence that we all have with the Buddhist idea of no self? So I don't think they're contradictory, as in my own thinking. So for no self, you know, for me that means no fixed self, no conditioned self, no self that's creating this the story about some reality. It's about the, you know, the connecting to this luminosity, if you will. So dropping off of the conditions that are arising in the moment, the fixed self, the idea of a fixed self, and connecting to something that's impermanent and luminous, I would say. So I don't, at least at this stage in my understanding of the Diamond Approach, I'm not seeing a conflict. I'll let you know if I do. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I have dealt with a lot of grief over the past 6 months. Yesterday I lost a cat that was a very dear pet. I don't have any nuclear family here. I lost my mother 6 months ago, and I sometimes find it difficult to. You're talking about having a story, and I find it difficult to grieve in such a way that I get giving myself the kind of internal support that I need and not expecting it from other people, because there's some degree where, I mean, when I look for the support externally, it feels like no matter how much someone wants to support, it just feels like there's this vacuum. I don't know. Repeated losses like that, it just goes to general to kind of nurture myself in a way that I need and create in such a way that I'm not dismissing my feelings. So,
thank you. So, see if I can do justice to what you said. You were talking about a lot of grief that you've had, losses. And you recently lost a pet yesterday, is that correct? And feeling that you need support from others, but maybe not feeling, not connecting with that. And there's something about stories and wondering about, maybe you're seeing a conflict between connecting to your emotions and the practice. So this isn't about ignoring that or not acknowledging it or not being with our emotions. That's the basis of the practice, knowing what's going on and opening to that in whatever way we can, making space for it. That's not creating a story about anything. That's what's arising in the moment. That's what's true. So I hope that you can find the support to do that. This culture is not very good with grief. Lots of people are pretty uncomfortable with it. So to make your own space for that and to allow it, because that is what's present, that's real, that's true. And we need to connect with that in order to eventually be able to move to a different place. Thank you. So I'm seeing that the children are out there, so I'm afraid we're going to have to switch gears, or I'm happy that we're going to switch gears. If anybody wants to talk about this afterwards, we can do that. Thank you.